This is the cycling podcast of the 2025 Tour de France with Lionel Burney, Graham Wilgos and friends, brought to you in association with Van Rysum.
Today we're in Le Mont d'Or, Puy de Sancy.
Lionel, Bastille Day, that was the sound of fireworks from last night, actually, in Châteauroux. After we were done recording and eating, I went for a little wander, and I was very pleased to find that the locals were celebrating early. But fireworks, entirely appropriate for today, for what we saw on the road.
Yeah, fireworks from start to finish, wasn't there, on this stage that really looked horrendous to ride, up and down all day. Climbs that weren't even categorised, that were bigger than some of the categorised climbs. It was a great day of racing on the Tour de France, on the French national holiday, of course, Bastille Day, July the 14th.
So, we should place ourselves before we go any further on July the 14th. Where are we?
Well, we're in a town called La Bouboule, which is, 8-10 kilometres away from Le Mont d'Or, which is where the stage finished today. Appropriate place to be this evening because this town has hosted Irish success on the Tour de France, because Stephen Roach won his final Tour stage in 1992, and just up the road at Le Mont d'Or, Ben Healy pulled on the yellow jersey as race leader of the Tour de France, the first Irishman to do so since Stephen Roach in 1987, when he won the Tour overall.
He was the Catherine Wheel that just wouldn't quit, wasn't he, in terms of fireworks today, after a few strobes went off the front.
Oh, he was the Catherine Wheel, wasn't he? Just went on and on and on and on. I mean, he earned that yellow jersey and deserved to keep it for the best part of a week, but well, we're looking too far ahead of ourselves here, aren't we?
Far too far ahead, but suffice to say, it was quite the stage. It did not disappoint. A real roller coaster on the French National Day. So everyone with a bank holiday, with a day off today, they really had a treat.
Well, the riders didn't have a day off, did they? They were working hard. I mean, we rolled out of Châteauroux this morning at what time?
9 a.m.
Yeah. 9-ish. Yep. And we were joining the convoy of team buses going from Châteauroux, because a lot of the team stayed in the town that we were in last night. They prepared for the hardest day of the Tour de France so far with a 2.25 hour ride in the bus. Now, I know those buses are comfortable and luxurious, but blimey, you kind of forget that when you then get back in the car after we've done all the stuff at the start and switch on the commentary and hear that the brakes are firing off within sort of 5-6 kilometres of the start. Their warm-up was sitting in that bus for a couple of hours, and tonight they've got a 4.5 hour transfer down to Toulouse. I think all of the teams are going down to Toulouse. Tomorrow at least they do get a rest day.
And the Bahrain Victorious bus would have seen me make a little mistake as well. Oh. So I've not been covering myself in glory this week, have I?
Never mind. Shall we crack on with the tale of the attack then? Stage 10, the last one before the rest day. A stage too far for some people. I think lots of tired legs out there. They'll be very grateful of a bit of an easier day tomorrow. But it was from Enezat to Le Mont d'Or, Puy de Sancy, 165 kilometres, with all of these climbs along the way. And
Straight off the front,
the local boy, Julian Alaphilippe. And we actually passed a Pizzeria Lulu on our way into the start, didn't we? The omens were there, and Alaphilippe kicked it off. There was a group of 19 that went away, then about 10 went across to them. Well, it was exactly 10. So we had this break of 29 up the road. I won't list them all, but crucially, Healy was in there with three teammates from EF Education Easy Post. They were Nielsen Powlis, Alex Bodin, and Harry Sweeney. Visma Lisabike had both Simon Yates and Victor Campenaerts in there. Well, should we deal with the story of the stage first before we talk about the GC?
I think that's the right way round.
It is. They went over all of these climbs, and with 80 kilometres to go or so, the break started to split up, and it was back down to 19 riders again. By about 65 kilometres to go, Ben Healy was the virtual yellow jersey on the road, because the gap was well over 6.5 minutes. Alex Bodin was giving the ride of his life.
He really was. And that's 6 minutes it started to be, because they were kept on quite a tight leash to begin with, weren't they? And it just gradually grew and grew and grew. And before you knew it, 50Ks to go, 6 minutes off the front, approximately. And you had like Ben O'Connor testing the group. You had Quinn Simmons having a crack. Ben Healy, of course, riding on the front, as you say.
Well, when did he make his first move? 46 kilometres to go.
In Healy range.
Absolute.
Nailed it.
The Healy sweet spot. He accelerated there. He actually got dragged back in. Everyone alert to what he was going to do.
Yeah.
But Bodan, who got dropped, then went back to the front again and started setting the pace again for EF. We saw Victor Campenaerts make a little move. And then Healy went over the top of the Col de Guerre in first place. And that teased away a move with Healy, Ben O'Connor and Joe Blackmore, the young British rider with Israel Premier Tech. That all came back together again. Quinn Simmons had a go, as you say, and the final move really was on this mammoth Col de la Croix-Robert. Now, officially, it was only like 5-6 kilometres long, but there was a long, long drag up and over a little false flat before the actual categorised bit of the climb, and that is where Ben Healy whittled it down. Quinn Simmons got dropped, so five in front. Healy, O'Connor, Yates, Timon Arensman of Ineos Grenadiers, and Michael Storer of Tudor Pro Cycling.
But for Healy to have done that time and time again already, when it's been nothing but up and down all day. So it was 8 categorised climbs today. 7 of them were Cat 2, 1 Cat 3. And you had 2 of those Cat 2s to finish as well. But it was so little of it of today was on the flat.
Almost nothing on the flat, was it? And Ben Healy was riding so strongly to make sure that the gap didn't come down as the aggression kicked off behind. We'll come to that in a bit, but the race for the stage, Healy really, well, he set himself up for the sort of counter punch, but he was racing for the yellow jersey.
He was racing for yellow, but everyone behind him knew that. The 5 riders sitting in his slipstream knew that, and so they were quite happy to get an armchair ride until it suited one of them to go.
It was the Giro d'Italia champion, Simon Yates, who of course won the Giro without actually winning a stage. He attacked with 3.5 kilometres to go. Healy did try to react but couldn't latch onto the back wheel. Ben O'Connor did go across to Yates, and Timon Arensman tried to. O'Connor got dropped when Yates kind of accelerated again with 2.5 to go. Arensman in the final K was really closing that gap, but Yates is a wily old competitor, isn't he? He must have known that. The team car was probably telling him, just let him get to close enough and then hit him again with
and
the final acceleration.
And it felt like he was dancing on the pedals in the end there as well. He was still fresh enough to look that good coming across the line, whereas you really felt with Arensman for Ineos, you really felt like he was struggling to close the gap at that point.
So Simon Yates, 3rd Tour de France stage win of his career, the first since he won twice in the space of 4 days back in 2019. And he was ahead of Timon Arensman, Ben Healy in 3rd, Ben O'Connor 4th, Michael Storer 5th, Joseph Blackmore of Israel Premier Tech, Great Britain rider making his Tour debut in 6th, Anders Halland Johannesson of Uno X 7th, Lenny Martinez 8th, and that was it for the riders that survived from the break, because Tadej Pogacar led in the rest. Ben Healy had a nervous old wait, didn't he, to see whether he had the yellow jersey, but in the end it was comfortable. 29 seconds Ben Healy now leads the race.
But what about the GC race, Lionel? Because it really was a stage of 2 races today. You had the break, plus you had the race for the yellow jersey. So in a way, it was a stage of 3 races. You had the race for the stage, then the race for the yellow, which was really a race that Ben Healy was running all of his own. Then you had the big GC battle coming in behind, and that really started to show with Pavel Sivakov dropping off the back quite early. We saw Tim Wellens riding on the front. We saw Nils Pollitt do a real big turn for Team UAE, or UAE Team Emirates, I should say. But it came down to Visma Lisa Bike punching off the front time and again. At the end there, we saw Sepp Kuss go. We saw Victor Campenaerts back working on the front again. And we saw Matteo Jorgensen go in that final 20K or so.
Well, yeah, Sepp Kuss and Matteo Jorgensen really went 1-2, 1-2, didn't they? And what was interesting was that today Pogacar was isolated at the top of that penultimate climb, the last one before the rise up to the finish. First time we've seen him on his own without any UAE Team Emirates teammates, because Adam Yates and Jonathan Narva Narvaez were distanced. They didn't make the split when it broke up on the climb. And as you say, Sivakov was not a factor today. There might be something wrong with him because he is a much better rider than to get distance 100k from the finish.
I actually had a chat with Sepkus briefly this morning at the start, and I mean, no surprise here, he was happy to say that without question this was a day on which Visma Elisabike would try and make a difference tactically that suited them, and tactically it was, or rather it was a course that was far more suited to try to make those differences given that it wasn't a high mountain.
We'll get into the tactics in the next part, I think, but we need to just kind of recap what happened, because Visma Elisabike went for this 1-2 strategy. They isolated Pogacar, but then when it came down to the final climb, it was Pogacar who was on the front foot again. Although Remco Evenepoel did have a little go, and Oscar Onley was very, very alert, but Pogacar kept his cool, chose his moment, teased Vingegaard out onto the wheel, and, well, told us what we already know about this tour, that they are the best two riders. So Pogacar and Vingegaard took a few seconds, 6 seconds, in fact, from Remco Evenepoel. And the GC rider that lost ground today was Kevin Vauclain, who slipped 3 places from 3rd to 6th. The rest of the top 10 is more or less as was. Tobias Halland Johannessen moved up into 10th, Primož Roglič 9th, Florian Lipovic 8th, Onley 7th, Vauclain 6th, Jorgensen and Vingegaard 5th and 4th, Evenepoel 3rd, Pogacar 2nd, and Healy 1st, the 4th Irishman of all time to wear the yellow jersey after Seamus Elliott in 63, Sean Kelly in 83 and Stephen Roach in 87. 3 abandons today, or rather 3 riders out of the tour, because Marijn Vandenberg of EF Education First was a rider who didn't take the start, and then Georg Zimmermann of Intermarché and Soren Wallenskold of Uno X were both riders to pull out. Wallenskold crashed yesterday, so that explains his troubles. And lastly, the race for the King of the Mountains on Bastille Day. Lenny Martinez of Bahrain Victorious went out like a little pocket rocket.
Every point available he was scooping up, wasn't he?
Over the first 5 climbs, he was the top to all of them. He faded a bit in the finale. There was the bizarre sight of him getting a nosebleed on one of the climbs. I mean, that's one way to get the polka dot jersey, isn't it? But Lenny Martinez will wear polka dots when the race resumes on Wednesday. He is on 27 points. Healy is on 16. And a little bit of family history. People probably know already that Lenny Martinez's dad and grandfather were both professional cyclists. His dad, Miguel Martinez, was a world mountain bike champion in the year 2000. And his grandfather, Mariano Martinez, was the King of the Mountains in 1978 and also won a tour stage on Bastille Day in 1980 at Morzine. So
wasn't to be today, though, for continuing the family tradition, unfortunately.
Not quite, but he's got a jersey to show for it. Should also just say, Ben Healy is now also leading the young rider classification ahead of Remco Evenepoel, but Evenepoel, of course, will wear the white jersey on Wednesday. Wow, it feels like we've crammed, what was it?
It's just
4 hours,
so,
20 minutes
so
and 5 seconds.
So much happened today.
Yeah, into...
What a day of racing.
13 minutes.
The voice of Radio Tour, sitting at the back of the pack.
A very big thank you to Van Riesel Cycles, who have sponsored us since Lille. And they leave us here in the Massif Central. They've sponsored the opening block of our Tour de France coverage this year, and we are incredibly grateful to them. We've been very proud to be associated with Van Riesel Cycles this week, and we wish them all the best as they go on their journey to become one of the biggest bike brands in the world, and they're going to do that. There was a bit of breaking news earlier this week, which I teased earlier on in the tour, but Van Riesel will be supplying the bikes for a top-level women's team starting in 2027. This is Maxime Delabre of Van Riesel Cycles.
The pro cycling team will have a new women team in 27. That's the news. It's super important for us. Not only women, by the way. I was having this discussion very recently. We really want to play a role to, unleash the sports and make it more global, embracing, you know, every type of riders, which is quite you know, if we look at people doing cycling, it's, people are very similar. We want to make that change. But don't forget, okay, this is what we want to do. We are a young brand with a young team, small team. We're doing our best to go fast, but we'll go that in that direction, step by step.
So it's not that it seems strange to talk about Simon Yates' win, because it was a brilliant, brilliant win from the break. But Ben Healy, to me, is the big story today. However, we should hear from a man who knows Simon Yates very, very well, having been his DS for a long time. Should we get Whitey's whiteboard on the go?
This is Matt White, former sports director of Simon Yates' old team, which is now Jayco Alula, of course.
Well, Bastille Day did not fail to deliver. A very, very aggressive, entertaining day of racing we witnessed today. The things that stood out for me, well, besides the brutalness of the entire stage, the size of the breakaway, there's a couple of combinations of teams which I would have expected to see in there. I think some teams were sitting on the fence whether they thought that the break could stay or not, or they thought it was going to be a bit of a GC battle behind. As it turned out, the break was just too strong. You'll see many similar faces in that break today, as you will see, as you have seen in the past 10 days, but you will also see again in the last 9 days of racing, because these guys who made the break today were the strongest guys on most terrains, really, apart from the high mountains. UAE certainly gave their trio of Marc Soler, Tim Wellens, Niels Politz a very, very hard day in the office controlling that break. My only thoughts of why they rode so hard for that a stage like today is teams classification. I really do see Tade going for all the jerseys, and if that break had blown out today with two jumbo in there, that would have pretty much given Visma the team's classification on a platter. They're still leading and have a handy lead, because I just don't see the reason why UAE had to ride so hard and really give those three riders a really tough day. I know the rest day tomorrow, but there was no point in it because, you know, Tade was happy just to follow moves behind. The other thing that stood out, I know it was an aggressive final, but for what reason? Did Visma really think that they would see a chink in Tade's armor on a stage like today in the final? So basically they isolated each other. You know, Visma, you know, UAE, Visma, their domestics and their key workers just eliminated each other from the final. And then we didn't even see a battle between Tade and Jonas on the final climb of the day. So the only thing it did achieve is some more fatigue for riders that will be called upon in the coming days. So an entertaining day, another brilliant stage win for Simon Yates. He's first in 6 years at the Tour de France, but he did look very much under control there. And he's going into the race really with no pressure on his back after winning the Giro. And we saw in 2019 when he went to the Tour de France with the bike exchange there, with having done GC at the Giro and then just going on the hunt for stages. He's more than capable of picking off stages on very varied terrain, as he won two stages and would have won three there in case that stage, except for the stage was cancelled due to a landslide when he was away with Bernal. But a great win for Simon Yates, what caps off an incredible year for him so far. On to a very well-deserved rest day, and then some will say the real Tour de France starts in the next 48 hours after a relatively flat day in Toulouse, then into the high mountains.
I mean, Simon Yates came into this Tour de France with no pressure on his shoulders, really, having won the Giro d'Italia. He's here in very much a support role for the team, Jonas Vingegaard, and he's going to be a super domestique in the big mountains, isn't he? But the interesting thing was, what was he doing in that break with Victor Campenaerts today? And, well, he mentioned it in the press conference. He was there, twin strategies, really. One was be up the road just in case things kicked off behind and he could be of some use to Vingegaard later on in the stage, as Campenaerts kind of was, wasn't he, when he got caught over that final climb and did a bit of work on the descent. But then it became obvious that the gap was not going to come down enough and Simon Yates could play his own cards and go for the stage win. And he's a very, very wily rider. He didn't get carried away with anything. He let Ben Healy do what Ben Healy was going to do, as they all did, really. But then he picked his moment perfectly. And as I say, on that run into the finish, the real experience was he knew Arensman was coming. He didn't panic. He just waited and then just turned on the gas for that final run to the line.
It's almost like he was riding tempo in those final kilometres in that drag up to the finish line. I thought it was almost like a little bit of a microcosm of the way he rode the Giro d'Italia. When you're looking at the break, it was kind of like, oh, look, Simon Yates is also in there. And he was just kind of hiding away like he did throughout the Giro until the fireworks went off on the Col de Finestra.
Well, the two interesting things are that he was also in the break the day Ben Healy won at Via Normandy, doing more or less the same kind of thing. And the other thing was, what was interesting was that UAE Team Emirates clearly let the gap go out and stay out enough, perhaps to give Tadej Pogacar a day off from the yellow jersey protocol.
And to burn Simon Yates out, or to burn the riders that they had up the road out.
Exactly. Thinking, well, you know, they're having a big day out in the break. They're going to be sort of wearing through a bit of energy. And, you know, it was kind of this kind of balancing act for UAE Team Emirates. And they gave the break just enough rope so that Ben Healy could take the yellow jersey. But Simon Yates really, you know, pressed home that advantage. He didn't waste the opportunity, and he's come away with a stage win. And that, in a Tour de France that may well not go Jonas Vingegaard's way, in a way, that kind of lifts the pressure a bit on Visma Lisebike. It's given them something, at least.
Absolutely. When you look at it from the point of view of, they gave themselves those two options. Either Simon Yates was a satellite rider, or he was going to be able to sit up there and pick his moment to go for the win, particularly on when you consider the composition of the break, as Whitey says there. It's actually very, very smart, but you can look at it another way. I spoke to Jonathan Vauters, the head honcho at EF Education Easy Post. There was obviously, well, for obvious reasons, there was a bit of a queue outside the EF bus in the paddock. Shall we hear how he saw those last few incredibly tense minutes as the rest of the riders crossed the line, and particularly the GC riders crossed the line? JV, congrats. Best part of 30 seconds in the end. What was all the fuss about?
Yeah, exactly. The best part of it. Yeah. I mean, it was tense in there for a long time. We at one point had to make a definitive call as to whether to play the stage, which would have been totally different with four riders in the break, right? I mean, it would, or if we were going to like gamble it all and go all in for the yellow jersey. And, you know, this is the luxury of having won a stage, because we said, well, we've won a stage, so let's try to get the yellow.
What are your emotions there in the last 5-6 kilometers where it was touch and go for a long time?
Yeah, I mean, we were just looking at time gaps, looking at our watches, looking at our, I mean, just any information we could get from anywhere. Really nervous. We're pretty damn scared when Visma started accelerating the race. I mean, UAE, you know, they were riding a tempo, but I don't think they were overly fussed about giving the jersey away. Visma, I don't exactly ever understand what Visma does, but like they were doing something trying to get rid of Pogue and didn't work, surprise. And you know, that broke the gap down. I mean, that's what hammered the gap down is. And so we were pretty worried.
And am I right in thinking that, or am I right in saying that after stage six, Ben was like, right, now I'm going for yellow?
No. We weren't really thinking about that because, you know, he had a little bad luck the other day with that crash. And you know, today we just said we're going to stack the break with as many people as we can get in there, and then let's play it from there. And it was a little bit like, well, okay, you know, is this a stage? Is this a, I mean, in our meeting in the morning, we said, listen, no matter what, you guys are really strong. We've got one of the better teams in the race. You know, the guys are all healthy. They're recovering well. So we knew that we were going to be really good this deep into the race without a rest day. And you said, let's just light it up, have fun. We've already won a stage. Pressure's off. And you know, see where that gets us to. And we didn't actually make like a definitive call like yellow versus this versus this stage until pretty far in.
Interesting there, Graham, they had to make that call on the road, because of course four riders in the break. We saw Alex Bodan working so hard, he wasn't going to be the potential stage winner. Nielsen Paulus was dropped out of that break at a certain point as well, wasn't he? So it was all going to be down to Ben Healy. And I suppose when the gap went up enough, suddenly that whole idea came into play. And, you know, Ben Healy must have been sitting there hoping that the gap would go up enough. And then he knew the moment where he had to kind of seize the initiative and just keep it going. He was asked in the press conference by our colleague David Walsh whether when he's 80 years old he will remember the stage win or the yellow jersey most. And so, he said that the stage win was for him. It was what he'd been targeting. But the yellow jersey really was a team effort and was for the team. And I think they rode like that today. You know, they were mob-handed in that break and they executed a plan. And I've gathered this plan, you know, has been in the making since they won the stage a few days ago. But, you know, having the plan and then executing the plan, there's a huge gap between those two things.
Yes, and a bit like the stage that Ben Healy won in terms of the riders in the break and in terms of how the race unfolded, it kind of fell into their hands in a certain way today, or in a certain sense today. Yes, they still played the cards that they were dealt well. Talking to Tom Southern afterwards, DS on EF Education Easy Post, he was talking about how the possibility of a yellow jersey, yes, it had been sort of talked about, but it only became a sort of reality during the stage. It was a stretch, but it came down to the composition of the break because they fully expected someone else from the top 10 to be in there.
Interesting that, because I think Ben Healy was kind of the last guy who possibly could have got in there. With the best will in the world, Tadej Pogacar and Jonas Vingegaard are not going to be worried about Ben Healy over the course of 3 weeks. So, but anyone else up there, even a sort of Florian Lipovic, would have had the alarm bells ringing a bit more. So I think once Ben Healy had got in there and there was enough firepower and enough kind of joint will to really collaborate and drive that break. But as we said, UAE Team Emirates, it wasn't really in their interest to shut it down. They didn't need to shut it down. And then some of the aggression from Visma Elisabike at the end, I thought was an effort to kind of lift the pace in order to keep Pogacar in the yellow jersey and give him a bit of a busier early evening, and then keep him in the yellow jersey for the yellow jersey press conference on the rest day and so forth. But that didn't work out. A little bit of intel, people will be wondering what the yellow jersey will be eating tonight. They're heading down to Toulouse. They'll no doubt refuel on the bus. They'll be showered and changed and travelling down in comfort, albeit 4.5 hours on the auto route. But when they get to the team hotel on the outskirts of Toulouse, they will have the option of steak sandwiches and cheesecake waiting for them.
This is exquisite intel.
Yeah, there we go. Can I also, with apologies to David Walsh, spoiler his intro in the Times, because he came up with a great line about an Englishman, an Irishman and a Scotsman riding a Tour de France stage. The Englishman has won the stage, Simon Yates. The Irishman has taken the yellow jersey, Ben Healy. And the Scotsman, young Oscar Onley, another impressive day. Okay, lost a handful of seconds, but riding exceptionally well and going into the middle week of the Tour de France and the high mountains, very well placed overall, seventh.
He had recce'd today as well, so this was on his radar as one that possibly might suit him for a stage win, suit a rider of his talents. On teamwork, just very briefly, Jonathan Vaughters was very keen to give, well, the whole team credit, all of the riders credit, but in particular the three other EF riders in the break, Bodan, Harry Sweeney in particular, earning his moniker that we've given him on Flying Squad, or his place on Flying Squad, the Sweeney, alongside
Nielsen Paulus.
He was the first to go. I mean, Nielsen Paulus, of course, the first to really ride himself into the ground.
I mean, we're going to have to explain the Flying Squad. There's too many British references creeping into the podcast, Graham. The Flying Squad is a highly specialised mobile unit within the Metropolitan Police Serious and Organised Crime Squad. And in the 70s, there was a TV detective show, wasn't there, featuring the Flying Squad. And they sort of jumped into the cars sideways and did, you know, wheel skids and U-turns and... terrible.
What made Dennis Waterman famous?
Yeah. Another one. All of our listeners in America wondering who on earth Dennis Waterman is. He won the Coors Classic in 1980. No, he didn't. What else did we pick up from today's stage? Because we saw Remco Evenepoel have that little move on the finale, but then when push came to shove, he lost 6 seconds. I mean, oh, I don't want to criticise GC riders, and we do criticise them for just following the wheels and not trying anything. But when you look at a result like that, you realise why. The risk is often not worth the reward.
Yeah, I'm surprised in a way that he didn't have a crack earlier. But then, as you
well,
say...
Well, then he might have lost 26 seconds.
There you go. So just to round this off, Lionel, I was fascinated to know whether Ben Healy was getting any instructions from Jonathan Voorthuis, from Tom Southam in the team car, or whether he was riding blind, so to speak, whether he knew what the time gap was back to Tadej Pogacar and the chasing pack behind him. Here's what JV had to say.
What were you telling him in the car?
Well, at first we were telling him, take it easy. Let Harry do the work. Let Nielsen do the work. Let Alex do the work. We were just saying, Ben, you know, chill. Because, you know, Ben isn't particularly good at chilling. Like, he wants to go. Like, he wants to go early and often. And so we just kept, you know, Ben, get further back in the line. Don't, you know, listen, you don't need to make this race. Let your teammates make the race. But then, you know, as we got into the last 20K, we were just telling him, okay, Ben, like, nobody is your friend at this point in time. Nobody's going to help you. You're just going to have to put your head down and take it all the way to the line. And he did, without, you know, flawlessly.
And they're all sat. You had five riders.
Four riders.
Oh. No, five riders. Oh, in the wheel, getting an armchair ride for
him. Yeah. And amazingly, he still made it in third. I mean, he pipped two of them, so three of them. So, I mean, how he did that, he just dropped him off his wheel. I mean, it's, again, like, just an amazing rider at just, like, the resistance that he has, that he can just kind of tick it over. I mean, I'll be interested to see this power file tonight. It's probably extraordinary.
Have you ever had a rider like?
A breakaway rider? No, you know, the rider I always think of is Thomas de Gendt, but he's, like, lightweight mountain Thomas de Gendt. But then, also, we forget that Thomas de Gendt once finished third in the Giro, so maybe there are a lot of similarities there.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Well, Graham, it's been a brief visit to the Massif Central. It's always a region, I think, that the Tour de France, when it visits, the race really comes alive. The roads are fantastic. It's twisty, turny, up and down. There's barely a metre of rest. It's a very attractive region as well. Hilly, but not sort of mountainous, not overly developed. Quite nicely wooded. We're looking up at the trees here. Great cheese as well, the Auvergne cheese.
Superb cheese. I had some in the race village this morning.
There we go.
At a brief visit. It's also, I mean, I can attest to just how up and down it is, having come through Clermont-Ferrand and Montluçon, riding between London and Barcelona many, many years ago. But it's a beautiful place to be, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And where we were this morning, you could see Le Puy de Dôme on the horizon pretty much all day as we came down the motorway. And there's been some great stages here. I mean, okay, Super Bess, which is just the other side of the hill here. There was a fairly notorious stage win for Ricardo Rico in 2008 before he was kicked out of the Tour. Rui Costa won here in Super Bess, in 2011. And I actually stayed in La Bouboule that day. And you always see great stages here, or in the case of Stephen Roach's stage in 1992, you don't see, because I remember watching that stage on TV, the highlights of it on Channel 4, and famously the mist descended all day and they had no pictures of any of the stage, and all you saw was Stephen Roach kind of coming through the mist at the very end, crossing the line. But no mist to be seen here today. The sky was bright and
wall-to-wall
sunshine. The temperature dropped a bit, and I think that was significant. I bet the peloton was glad not to be baking in sort of 35 degree heat. It was a good 10 degrees cooler than that, actually.
As we were in the press room today, it wasn't too bad, was it? As we walked into the press room, we arrived at about 100 kilometres to go. Shortly thereafter, the riders took to the old French Grand Prix circuit at Cherard. I don't know if you caught this. You were
like Bond. Formula One is a real blind spot for me. James Bond and Formula One are very much not topics for me at all.
I think it's always an exciting thing to see, you know, riders on an F1 track. I mean, it's not my sport of choice particularly. It's a little way down in my kind of top five, top ten.
I must confess, Graham, I didn't actually see the riders on the motor racing circuit. I'm a big fan of races going on to motor racing circuits, maybe because when I watched the Tour in 1989, they went onto the circuit at Spa-Francorchamps in Belgium. But until Brian Nygaard, I think it was, pointed out that actually when you see the cyclists on the motor racing circuit, they just look incredibly slow. The circuits are designed for cars that go a lot quicker. I remember the Tour stage a couple of years ago, went to the Paul Ricard circuit at Nogaro, and his point really sort of stood out to me there. But obviously didn't finish on the circuit today. They just went onto it a bit, did they?
And they did. And it sort of takes me back to the stage where the riders began lining up in grid formation a la F1. But I mean, there are a lot of good reasons why the two don't usually mix.
Yeah, that was an absolute washout, wasn't it? They've never repeated that experiment. What year was that? 2018? I want to say it was in the Pyrenees, certainly.
Yeah.
Richard and I recorded next to the grid start, and then were we at the top watching the grid start? I can't remember.
It was really built up, and it became a bit of a damp squib.
It was absolutely rubbish. I mean, I get the idea of innovating, but that didn't work. What I would say is good classic style stages are what make the Tour de France great. The first 10 days have been fantastic. Even the inverted commas boring days have been interesting, enlivened of course by Mathieu van der Poel and Jonas Rickaert yesterday. The stage to Dunkirk where Jasper Philipsen crashed out, probably the exception because the drama all centered around crashes rather than the racing. Otherwise that was a pretty dull stage, but really it's been a great week of racing. I mean, 10 very, very intense days. Maybe it's because I missed the Tour last year and I kind of forgotten a little bit what it's like, you know, the early starts, the traffic jams, losing cables and wires for all of our various recording equipment and so on. Just the feeling of always being 10 minutes behind where you need to be. But the intensity of the racing this year has felt like another level, and I think the course this week has had a lot to do with that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, hard not to, isn't it? Just one last note on Mathieu van der Poel. I overheard, but didn't understand, a conversation he had in Dutch with our colleague in the press room, Sam de Vogt from NRC, the Dutch newspaper. He asked Mathieu about the days ahead, and particularly today. And van der Poel's response was, "On my way here," as in to the race start, "I opened the route book for the first time, and it scared me a little bit. I thought there were more easy stages, but it's almost a heavy climbing stage every day from now on. As a team, we're used to fading to the background at this point." Obviously, he's talking about Alpecin De Koninck. "We're a classics team, so we have no business riding in the mountains."
Well, we'll see whether he mounts a bid for the green jersey. I did actually want to pick up on that because the break went before the intermediate sprint, and so Jonathan Milan was never going to get any points today. The break took all of the points. Tadej Pogacar took 14 points at the finish, and so the gap is now 64 points in Jonathan Milan's favour. That is only, well, three and a bit stage wins for Pogacar. So Milan is going to have to get some points when the race resumes in those intermediate sprints.
So Lionel, going back to the start of the day, and when we pulled up at the paddock for the team buses to see, you know, what was what, who was about, you disappeared. Where did you go?
Well, I went to the Ineos Grenadiers bus and spent a long time standing outside it. Nobody was really giving me any eye contact or encouragement to come over and have a conversation. So I wandered off again. And then when I went back, right before the start, literally a few minutes before the start, Dave Brailsford was chatting to Geraint Thomas. And when Geraint got on his bike and went to the start line, I said hello to Dave Brailsford and I asked him about this ARD investigation and story, which centres around one of their staff members and alleged links to the Operation Adalas doping investigation. He said definitively he would not be commenting. And, well, I said that maybe the story might blow up a bit if he remained silent about it, as it does relate to events in 2012 in the run-up to Bradley Wiggins winning the Tour de France. Now, there's a lot of unanswered questions about that Tour de France, not least what was in the jiffy bag in 2011 at the Dauphiné, the circumstances surrounding the TUE that was applied for within the rules for Triumph Cinelone for Bradley Wiggins, but also the hiring of the doctor from the Rabobank team, Geert Leinders, who have been involved in pretty industrial doping with the Rabobank team. And, you know, we've never really had satisfactory answers to any of these points. And now we have a story that has brewed. The German ARD broadcaster has completed this investigation based on court documents. It's not just kind of hot air. There are court documents to back this up. We, of course, haven't seen those court documents, so we're being a bit careful here. We're not naming the staff member in question. But another media outlet has, and it's kind of a bit of a talk in the press room. But Brailsford was adamant that he wouldn't be saying anything. But then at the finish, you were down at the Ineos Grenadiers bus, and, well, the story developed. It's kind of gone in another direction now, really.
Yeah, I mean, unsurprisingly, I was one of a small handful of journalists who had made our way down to the Ineos bus because Sir Dave Brailsford was again standing outside, and he was in quite good form and in good humour to begin with, and kind of batted the questions away to start with. But he came to the point very quickly that same thing he said to you: I'm not going to take it on. I'm not going to say anything on that. And then when he was pushed on it, he kind of said, "What did I just say?" And then pushed on it again, and he made a very quick exit, quite a frustrated exit towards the Ineos bus.
I mean, it's interesting, this, isn't it? Because, you know, Dave Brailsford was kind of the architect of the Team Sky era. All of those Tour de France wins for Bradley Wiggins, Chris Froome, Geraint Thomas, Egan Bernal. He stepped away to go and work in football at Nice Football Club in France, and then Manchester United, famously. And he's come back to the cycling team after a few years away. And you would think, I kind of got the line at the start of the week, that he doesn't want to step on the toes of the staff that are here, that have been working towards the Tour de France. Completely understand that. But he is here in a capacity where he's just on a watching brief at the moment, but he is here as a member of the Ineos Grenadiers staff. And presumably he's going to have a big role in next year and the year after and the year after. And he's back, and he's not spoken to anyone in the media on the record. Well, our chat was not on the record. It was just a chat. It kind of feels quite surreal that stories from the past, the ghosts of Team Sky's past, are still kind of hovering over the Ineos Grenadiers bus. And I do think, I'm not a PR expert, but I do think he probably has to front up and explain exactly what, confirm or deny, really. That's kind of how it goes. We'll see how it goes in the coming days, what kind of coverage there is in some of the national newspapers or the foreign media. But, yeah, it's a bit of a kind of lukewarm, decaffeinated return to the days when we were all outside that Team Sky bus asking all sorts of questions about Geert Leinders, the doctor, or, you know, we didn't come to know about the Triumph Cinelone for Bradley Wiggins until much later. But, yeah, a little kind of wishy-washy return to the old days. Quite strange, really.
I said frustrated. I think I'm going to upgrade that to exasperated. It was an exasperated exit.
We should probably wrap up a bit here, Graham, because we've got to get south as well. We're staying in Brive-la-Gaillarde tonight, splitting the journey. We're not going all the way to Toulouse, but we've got a treat in store for the rest day, which will be out for kilometre zero. Fingers crossed that comes off. It's the annual cricket match tomorrow as well, isn't it?
Yes. I think. I was about to say, it feels strange there. I was about to say, let's do tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner. There is no tomorrow's stage for the
wonderful
first time in 10 days. There is no tomorrow's stage. So I think, you know, we could probably do a little recharge ourselves. But, yeah, looking forward enormously to the cricket match in Toulouse, a few staff members from a couple of the teams, plus a very healthy or unhealthy, depending on how you want to look at it, journalist representation out there too.
What day will it be? Wednesday will just be a whole series of physical gripes, pulled muscles, strained backs, you know, sore elbows and shoulders. I mean, what batting, bowling? What's your specialty?
I'm a useless batsman. I can and almost equally useless bowler. I've got my hand-eye coordination is still excellent. Charlie Wigelius was very impressed with my fielding last year. I caught two in the air. I think one was from Mitch. I caught one in the air with a beer in my hand.
Excellent. I will be there in some capacity or other. May even make it onto the field. Who knows? I mentioned kilometre zero there. We took a little bit of a break today because it's Bastille Day. Give everyone a day off on Bastille Day. But we've got an episode coming tomorrow. It's one that I'm really excited about. It'll be available for everybody on the free feed. It's called Chapter and Verses, and it features a trailblazer in professional cycling. Shelley Verses was the first woman to work as a soigneur in the professional peloton. She was with the 7-Eleven team when they first rode the tour in 1986, and some of her stories are incredible. And this is the first episode of a little mini series which may well expand into a longer run of episodes later on in the year. The only other thing to say, Graham, before we go, is a big thank you to our production team. John Mooney, who's been with us since day one in 2013, Tom Wally, Adam Bowie and Hugh Owen. But a special thank you to tonight's producer, Will Jones. Will has been with us since the 2016 Vuelta a España. He and his family are moving to Australia a bit later on this year, and he is bowing out after fantastic service here, making episodes for us, the regular episodes, the Cycling Podcast Feminine, which he has basically taken on since the start of the Cycling Podcast Feminine, which also I think was 2017, so a long run. And he will be producing the entirety of our Tour de France fam coverage a little bit later on this month. But Will has been a fantastic member of the team. We're sad to lose him, but we wish him all the very best for him and his family with his new life down under. I think he's going to be close to Mitch, isn't he?
He is, isn't he? Or you say bowing out, he's bouncing out like a kangaroo on a trampoline.
Oh my goodness. Thank you, Will.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Byrne.